Welcome to the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. We are your hosts, Martijn Bron and Alexander Sterk.
Hello there, everyone. Welcome to yet another episode of the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. And I'm very happy that today we have the first oil trader. We have Ed Turner, formerly head of trading from Mandara. Now a sake entrepreneur, but also almost going back into the oil trading market for Gunvor in October. And I'm really happy that we have him because I got to know Ed last year in London when I visited Mandara, and I was impressed by how open he was, how clear he was about his philosophy, and also some of the materials that Mandara shared for me to look into. Like, a risk management policy is one of the best things I've read. And Ed told me that he wrote the document, and also some of the things I saw on the trading floor, how he dealt with young traders, was very, very impressive. Yeah, so it's also interesting for us to now have someone who really knows the energy markets well, because most of the traders that we have had so far were agricultural traders. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to talk to you, Ed.
Yeah, and I think it's one of the oil is for me always one of like the hardcore trading products that you can do. I mean, you have the Brent oil price, the WTI in the US. It's like, so I'm very interested in hearing that story from you. I must say, doing now a bit of an outstep into the liquor, I think it's not a bad one, of course. Every trader, I think, can only applaud for that one. So welcome to the podcast. And yeah, tell us a bit about you. How do you get to this story?
Sure. Thank you. Thank you for that intro. Try not to disappoint after those very kind words, Martijn. So I guess I'm probably closer to the middle of my career than many of your guests who you've had on. That's a kind way of saying it. Maybe I'm a little bit younger, but yeah, so I started trading about 12, 13 years ago. I first started trading at a small Japanese bank. Well, I should say a small branch of a very large Japanese bank, Mitsubishi UFJ International, which was the international trading arm of MUFG, which is one of the biggest banks in the world by deposits. And I traded base metals there for a couple of years. And after a couple of years, the bank decided they were going to wind down the business. At the time, I was obviously pretty upset. I was disappointed, worked hard to get to that point, finally found myself in a seat I really enjoyed. But actually, out of the ashes, it was one of the best things that could have happened to me, because I took the leap at that point into a very, very different type of business in Mandara, moving from a conservative Japanese bank with 100 people in the office on the floor to Mandara at the time, which was probably about 14 of us and about as intense a role as you could possibly imagine. But it turned out to be, for me, the perfect seat in terms of the ability to learn the markets, the training they afforded us, and then later on, the responsibilities provided to me by the owner, the opportunity to grow and learn there. It aligned perfectly with me as an individual. I loved it. And it was disappointing after 10 years for us to end up winding up the business, which I'm sure we'll touch on later, but it was the right thing at the right time. We'd achieved a lot of things. We'd had a lot of fun along the way, most importantly. And in winding up the business, although it was disappointing for some of the younger team, Ron was able to kind of walk away and was treated very well by the owner. And it was as a way for the business to go out. It wasn't like we blew up, like we lost money. So for me personally, it was a very nice way to end it.
The beginning of your career, eh? That was Mitsubishi, yeah?
Mm.
And that was a summer analyst role, yes, that you started with.
Yes.
Eh? If you watch or read LinkedIn, you see all the big banks, but also trade houses, hedge funds, they actively promote those summer analyst jobs. And yes, you usually see a huge amount of applications and a very tiny percentage of people who actually make it. But you also hear these stories about insane working hours, yeah, and in the weekends. Can you describe, I think, especially for the young people who are interested in, how did you get in?
Yes.
And how did you experience it? And was it really as tough as it was? And at the end of the day, were you happy that you had done it? Could you describe, sure, what it was like?
Yeah, you see like the programs like Industry, and you read these articles in the FT these days, and I'm like, well, if I was doing that now, I would not survive, that's for sure. I mean, I think it was maybe 15 years ago when I joined Mitsubishi as a summer intern. And to be frank, I had no idea what I wanted to do at that point. I had very little experience or understanding of what happened in the city. At 16, my girlfriend's dad, who is now my father-in-law, took me in to Credit Suisse. He was a Japanese equity salesperson. He loved his job. He had built up a brilliant client base over the years, spent a lot of time out for nice dinners and lunches and having a great time. And I thought, oh, this looks good.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah, that sounds fun. So he took me in, and I experienced trading for the first time, and it was an interesting experience. But on the second day, we got up at 4:30 or 5 each morning to get into the office on time, because he was trading Japanese, obviously. I was sat in a meeting with two people like this, a head of compliance on one side and me and another intern on the other side, and I fell asleep. And that was probably the, he still, rips it out of me to this day that, you know, his head of compliance, he was trying to impress, and, I've fallen asleep in front of her. So that was not the best start to my city life. And then my other exposure was through my dad, who was a lawyer. You know, he came from, him and my mum were both RAF babies. So, you know, they came from a very different background. He was the first of his family to go to college. He got a scholarship to Cambridge, and then worked incredibly hard to forge a very successful career in shipping law. And, you know, it was my first exposure to obviously kind of shipping market wide as well, which I found fascinating. But I did know that I didn't want to go into law, because he was an amazing dad, but I didn't want to work the hours he was working. I didn't want to work the weekends and the travel and all this sort of thing. So that was really all I knew about the city. And when I was at University of Nottingham, the first summer, one of my housemates went to get an internship at JP Morgan, and he worked there for 10 weeks, and he came back and he's like, it's amazing. You know, I made $8,000 for my 10 weeks, and that blew my mind. At that time, I was like, that's insane. That's awesome. How do I get some of that? So the next summer, I took his notes, and he kind of fake interviewed me, and I applied to JP Morgan for exactly the same role as he did. And I applied to Mitsubishi UFJ as well. I got both offers, and simply because he gave me this, you know, this basically free pass, and I'm sure I would have flunked out otherwise. And then I decided at the time to take the Mitsubishi role, and everyone who I spoke to about it thought I was a bit bonkers, because JP Morgan is the most successful investment bank in the world. My thought process was, it was the first year that Mitsubishi UFJ were doing this, I'll call them MUSI, and this is what they call themselves, were doing this internship. So I knew that they wouldn't really have all their ducks in a row, and I would be able to probably get exposure to a lot more of the business, and, you know, be able to kind of not be pigeonholed in the same way that the JP Morgan internship would have been. And so that's why I joined this business. It's a very much smaller business, and it was brilliant, because I'd got some decent training to start with, a couple of weeks in the classroom, and then I got the opportunity to really spend time with any of the areas of the bank that I thought was interesting. So I literally sat with finance, operations, middle office, on the trading floor, and equity capital markets. And then I sat on the equity convertibles trading desk and the commodities trading desk. And by the time I got to the commodities desk, it was the last desk I sat on. It kind of, you know, it felt really exciting, really interesting. When I was growing up, I played a lot of rugby. My body fell to pieces when I went to uni. So that was the end of that. And I sort of started transitioning from about 16, 17 to playing a lot of poker, a lot with my friends. You know, we played pretty high standard. One of the guys is still a pro. He does pretty well now. So we know we weren't playing it. We had fake IDs. Probably shouldn't say that on here, and go to casinos and play live and stuff. And I wasn't amazing, but I loved it. I loved the combination of the kind of risk management, the pot, or, you know, what they call it, pot odds and pot management, and also the psychology behind it, especially when you're sitting across the table looking someone in the eye. And yeah, that was kind of, when I first sat on the quantities desk, it felt like this kind of combination of those two things. You're in a small team, you've got the salespeople on one side, you've got the traders on the other side. They're kind of talking to each other all the time. They're shouting at each other. It's active, it's busy. And then, you know, you've also got that kind of more intellectual side to it, you know, where you're managing your risk, you're managing, you know, the price movements. And so for me at that time, it was like this kind of light bulb moment. I was like, yes, this is what I've been looking for. I've been looking for something to replace those kind of two things in my life, which neither of which I was going to be able to take further than I had been. And so I sat with that desk for a couple of weeks. And then I asked to come back the following summer to do another internship with them, which they were, you know, kind enough to say yes. I spent another 8 weeks there, and yeah, really just enjoyed it, enjoyed the team, enjoyed like having that product at the end of it when you're trading. When I'd sat on the other trading desks, you're talking about pieces of paper. When you're talking about companies, it's a bit more interesting, but I loved that tangible thing. And I would go home and I would talk to my granny, and she'd be talking about how her financial advisors told her to go and buy Cord. And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about, but sure. But I, you know, the ability to talk to anyone about this is really interesting, and it obviously impacts everyone every day. You can't necessarily say the same about like debt capital markets or something like that. So I did my 8 weeks at Mitsubishi, and it was brilliant. It was a great time. And they hired me on afterwards into a kind of full-time trading role where I was going to be trading base metals. So I had about 18 months or so trading base metals where, you know, starting absolutely not having a clue and probably ending having not much of a clue, but a little bit more. And, you know, sort of felt I was just getting going. I'd taken over trading the zinc and lead books, you know, the kind of smallest of the flow books, just trading like a sort of small swap flow, small options flow. When the Japanese bank decided to shut down, and Japanese companies are obviously very conservative. And at the time, actually, they had probably a pretty good optionality in the business. This was after the financial crisis, 2008. So this is 2011. A lot of the big banks started to divest all of their kind of commodities assets. And they had really, they also had very full credit lines at the time. So the way these banks work, they would offer out credit lines and then to big airlines and to other kind of commodities users. And they, with the knowledge they're going to come back and they're going to hedge with them. And they would be able to charge big margins to be able to do this. So at the time, Mitsubishi was one of the only shops on the floor that didn't have full credit lines. We had a lot of space. We could charge decent margin on trades. And, you know, for me, it was like, okay, this is good. This is right. But as all these other banks were stepping out of the business, they said, okay, let's do that too, which was a shame. As I said, it turned out to be good for me. But at the time I thought I was going to walk out the door. They offered me to come sit on some other trading desks. And I said, no, I don't want to go and trade credits or whatever. I want to stay in oil or stay in commodities rather. That was what was interesting me at the time. I was expecting then to kind of walk out the door, but they asked me to stay on and help unwind the metals portfolio, which I definitely wasn't expecting because it was a decent sized portfolio and I really didn't know what I was doing. But that was amazing. Like the next 6 months of learning of understanding the curve, understanding where we were holding our risk and, you know, different price points. And then, you know, the LME market is quite a kind of nuanced market in terms of how you roll out and hedge risk and things. And so managing that portfolio as we looked to sell on the book was really interesting. And I definitely learned a lot, probably more in that 6 months, or definitely than the previous 18 months. So I've been there. Just popped into my head that I realized I've unwound two books in my very short careers, which is not the best thing. Having unwound Mitsubishi UFJ and then unwinding Mandaras, but we'll come to that. So that was a brilliant experience. And then sort of towards the end of my time at Mitsubishi, I had started to want to transition out to the metals market. For me, it was not that an interesting market. It was quite an old boys club. You go out for dinner and you meet everyone in the industry and they're all the same age, same color. Like it was not very diverse. Whereas the old market, one of the guys on my desk had started taking me out and it was much bigger, much more fast paced and just it appeared to me to be a kind of sexier market, right? So at the time I was put in touch with the owner of Mandara who went by the name Alf back then, now Moorfax Salty or M. And so I went and interviewed at Mandara and it was like chalk and cheese going from Mitsubishi UFJ, it's slow moving, conservative Japanese bank to Mandara, where my first interview I went in and I was in a small room like this. I was hooked up to a heart monitor. I had some computer screens in front of me that were playing that had sort of numerical games on. And these things would refresh, starting off, they refresh every minute. And they didn't tell you that the speed at which they refresh would increase. So you're playing these games, you're like, that's pretty easy. And suddenly it's like refreshing really quickly. And at the same time, they're playing like rock music and metal music, like as loud as you can imagine. So I was doing all this and, you know, I was kind of thinking this is a bit mad. The head of performance at the time was a guy called James King. Is a very impressive person, very impressive performance coach. He was in the Marines and then left and studied psychology and performance and was picked up by Mandara specifically because he was very interested in aligning performance coaching and hiring with the skill sets that you're going to employ on a desk. And at the time, Mandara was a market maker through and through. So it was very fast trading all day, every day. You had to be able to operate in an incredibly noisy, busy environment under like extreme pressure and do that for like 12, 14 hours a day. And so they were trying to emulate that as closely as possible in that kind of early hiring process. And so I went through this hiring process and at the end of it, I met Moorfak and I was a bit unsure at the time about whether to take the role. I'd been told that there wouldn't be a better place to learn trading in terms of a training ground. They committed to, for those who kind of passed those early hurdles, really committed to improving them and helping them grow in the market. I'd also been told that the chance of when you join actually getting past that first year or 2 years was very low because it was so intense and the pressure was so high and the standards and performance expectations were so high. But and I was also going to take a 75% pay cut for the pleasure of it. So it wasn't an obvious decision, but I spent 15 minutes in a room with M and, you know, my mind was immediately made up. Although he doesn't really see it, he's a very charismatic individual and what he wanted to achieve from Mandara and, you know, how he wanted to grow the business and more importantly, you know, how he wants to do that culturally and the kind of principles and way that he wants to run the business really aligned with it, really struck a note with me. And I sat there and I thought, yes, this is, you know, I'm committed to this. And actually, you know, that there's probably like 10 times over the next 18 months, 2 years when I was like, you thought I made the wrong decision. It was so hard. You know, we were starting at 5 a.m. We were finishing at midnight. It was incredibly intense. You know, the culture back then was pretty poor as well. You know, it's like 80s, 90s Wall Street, like, you know, in terms of how people were treated and, you know, you really came in at the bottom and you really had to earn your stripes. And my friends and family were all like, you got to quit. This is awful. But I could see the kind of light at the end of the tunnel, so to speak. First of all, I knew the standard training I was getting and the expectations of me were just different than I would get anywhere else. And I also knew I had belief in myself that I could kind of get through that. And if I could get through that point where I wanted to get to, which was, you know, at that stage, it was all about running my own portfolio, building up my own business. You know, that entrepreneurial edge was always the thing that drove me. I didn't want to be a part of a team. I wanted to own that thing and to really drive that. And that kind of defined those kind of early years at Mandara.
It's already a fantastic story, yeah?
I'm listening to it and I'm like, wow, you know, what's the first question to ask you? Because there are many that go through my head. But looking at these stories, right, from the learnings and the internships to Mandara and the choices you've made, and also, you know, some of the interesting trading topics that you touched upon, right? And for me, was one that I wrote down here. I think that's a nice one because the moment you have extreme volatile markets in a lot of the, for example, let's say also in agri-food markets where you had cocoa went through the roof, dairy is now going, butterfats going through the roof. We had sugar last year went sky high. So people want to manage that risk. And you then touched upon, and I would love to see if you could explain that to us and listeners about the credit lines that you were discussing about airlines. And you said, well, they can hedge their own commodities. How did that work? What was that? You know, what were you doing there?
Yeah. So airlines, for example, obviously they're a consumer of oil. So they're worried about the price of oil going up.
Yep.
You know, and to be frank, from when I started even to now, they've become much better at hedging their own flows. You know, they're very advanced teams now that work in these businesses. So that kind of trading by banks is becoming less and less kind of fruitful. But they obviously want to be able to predict the price movements of oil going forward. They can't
Makes
do
sense.
That. So they want to try and lock in a certain price. They have lots of different ways of doing this, right? They can buy or sell swaps to know that if the price of oil goes above a certain level, you know, they're going to be okay. But they can also use more complex, more structured derivative contracts as well. So things like options, collars, so they can set a collar is like defining a price level that you're comfortable with between two, you know, high and low, and it goes above this, it goes below this, you know, you're going to be okay. And so, for a bank, you sit there and you've offered them credit. Okay, so you've given them $100 million. And the knowledge is that they're going to then, when they need to hedge their FX or they need to hedge their credit exposure or they need to hedge their oil price exposure, they'll come to you and they'll ask for a price. And they say, look, you know, we want to make sure that if the price of oil goes above $70 a barrel, you know, we're not going to be paying that. And then put them a price on this. Now, if they've come directly to you and they're not asking any other banks for price, you have a fine line to toe between trying to take as much profit as you can without annoying them enough that they're going to go, that's a bad price, they're going to go elsewhere. And so this was the kind of, back then, this was the kind of skill set of the traders and also the salesperson as well, because they would have a very good idea of the person sitting in their own line, how much they're willing to give up and all this sort of thing. It became, even while I was there in 2 years, like increasingly more competitive, despite the fact that a lot of the banks weren't competing, because the last few who were there wanted to try and win as much business, try and take over, you know, kind of the vacuum that was left by some of the bigger banks. So actually the margins were decreasing quite a lot during that period while they tried to take in this flow. And I you know, even I saw it, you know, you had constant arguments between the traders and the salesperson, with the salesperson going, come on, let's tighten it. And the traders going, well, we've got to make some money on this because we have this credit risk, right? We've given an airline, which is inherently a risky business, X amount of capital. You know, we have to make some money off the back of this, because if you price up that credit exposure for the bank, you know, there's X amount of basis points that we're at risk. You've got to make that up across the different desks, right? And that's how you've got to think and operate.
Yeah. And then thanks for that explanation. I think that's helpful. And then on the other thing that I would love to ask you is about a small and a big trading firm, right? So you've been in both ends. What are the, you know, I think a lot of people that I speak to in the trading, they're looking to go from, most times it's from, I go from a big one to a smaller one. You know, you learn a bit there and you try to apply it in a smaller one. Probably the other way around, of course, happens as well. But what would you say is for you the learnings and the big difference in that? What is...
It's difficult to pinpoint necessarily just relating to the size, because they are also two incredibly different types of business. You know, one was a large, very conservative corporation, you know, that was really trying to protect its credit risk, its reputation, you know, all of these things, as much as make money, so to speak. You know, our branch, our international that we were trading out of, they were there to provide a service, but they were a tiny, tiny part of the wider business. You know, I mean, there's several trillion dollars of deposits in Japan. So MESI, with its 800 employees and hedging international exposure across the products they were trading, is very, very small. It's like dropping ocean. So for them, it was about maintaining the status quo, so to speak. And Mandara, this is like the original challenger in the oil markets, the first market maker, the first truly kind of prop paper small shop like that, that really disrupted the market. And it was about high growth. It was about making the most of that and trying to convert as much of the kind of flows in the market, you know, bring them into the business as quickly as possible. Because to be frank, the returns that were being made on the capital risk and the risk need to be taken were insane. They were amazing. Of course, as the market became more competitive and we saw, and we had the last 10 years, we had many, many competitors pop up, many went under and some have become very successful. As that happens, your margins decrease. But at the time it was, well, when Moorfax set the business up, he was a fuel oil trader. So that was his edge. You know, that was his market. That was where he focused. Once that book was up and running and he had trained one or two other traders to trade and be able to do that, he then said, okay, well, this will work in the other product markets. He hadn't done it, so he wasn't sure. But the way that he traded the curve, the way that he was exploiting the kind of inefficiencies in the market should have worked, and they did. And so his role then became about training with James King, other people to trade these other product markets, which are related, all similar, but with their own individual nuance. And so that was kind of the high growth phase of the business. So the kind of similarities or differences between the two, of course, one's a big business, one's a small business, but what they were trying to achieve and how they're operating in the markets. I mean, it was like at a flow desk, you're sitting there waiting for flow to come in. You couldn't trade prop at a bank, really, you know, the Volcker rules and everything else that come in, Dodd-Frank after global financial crisis. So at the beck and call of your counterparties, and if they don't come knocking, well, you're going to sit there and wait. And ultimately, when they do come knocking, if you've got a full credit line, well, you're quoting to miss. That's not very fun. So the deals that you are quoting to win, it's, you know, it's a kind of a knife edge. Mandara, you are, you know, you're only as good as your last year of trading, right? I think one of your previous podcast, Javier Blas, he said it very well. He was quoting Ivan Glassenberg. He said, you know, as a trader, you start every year with a blank sheet of paper. You have to redefine yourself, redefine your edges and in your trading strategies and styles. And it's exactly that. The market is evolving all the time. And so we were like the epitome of a should have no edges business. You know, what were our edges? Well, our edges at the time were the kind of structural inefficiencies in the market, excellent risk management, excellent training, and being the first to try and do what they were doing. But obviously, as the markets evolve, those structural inefficiencies start to get ironed out. Mm. Okay, the inefficiencies in the market start to, well, the markets become more efficient, especially as you have more and more people trying to do the same things. Okay, so then you have to redefine yourself. What are your edges at that point? Okay, well, risk management was our edge all the way through. You know, that was the thing that kept us in business. And as I said, we didn't go out of business because, you know, we weren't making money or necessarily, or we blew up. Our risk management was always very good. So then it's about the kind of what we called the edge creation piece. What are the strategies? How do you make money when you don't have a part of the kind of physical supply chain? We're not moving physical barrels around the world. We don't own ships. We don't own refineries. So how do you generate money from nothing, essentially? And that was the skill. And that was the kind of the thing that I guess I'm proudest of us achieving over all that time. There was no reason why we should have been able to make the money we did. And Martin, you was, I think, quite surprised. And many people were when they got to look under the hood. They're like, well, what's there? Well, we don't have, you know, AI generated algorithms telling us to click this button or that. But we do have some of the best returns on capital in the market. We did achieve that over 10, 12 years. And that was down to, yeah, I mean, for me, when I started, I was trained. You know, I was trained in risk management. I was trained in the nuance of the oil markets, right? So every market is strange and weird and has its own ways of trading and the languages they use and all this sort of thing. And then I was trained in edge creation. A lot of people go, well, first of all, what does that mean? Okay, so it means that you have an ability to sniff out different ways of making money. And this is not just in trading, right? This is in life. If you're going to be an entrepreneur, how do you set up a business and find a placement in the world that is going to generate profits? So you have to find a niche. You have to find an edge. So you go, okay, well, how do you train this, right? How do you train someone to be an entrepreneur? You can give them certain skill sets, which is what we did, but then it's all about the hiring. They have to be curious. They have to be entrepreneurial, motivated to look down the rabbit hole and try and find these different strategies and this different way there's money. You cannot sit and rest on your laurels. And we had some, you know, we saw this very often where you'd have a very successful trader in a market. They built up this portfolio, this set of strategies, and, you know, they would leave. So their trainee, their junior would take over, and you're thinking, oh, they're pretty good. They've trained them really well. it'll be good. You know, it should be fine. He's got all these strategies. From day one, just slowly, slowly degrades. And a year later, the book's at like zero again, because they haven't actually given them the training on how to develop and find these strategies. They've given the training how to trade these strategies there at that one point in time. But in that one point in time, it's going to change. And so you have to have that ability to learn and evolve with it.
Yep.
You touched base on several interesting things. So the business model of Mandara, and if I compare it to, you know, what I thought what it was, and that's a bit like the discussion sometimes about, okay, what is trading? What is merchandising? What is sales trading, market making? Now, the way I was raised, I was spent a huge amount of time on fundamental analysis with a trading team and determining basis the S&D where a market would need to go. And you would take into account things like order flow and inefficiencies or arbitrages like you described. But my impression was that the essence of Mandara was market making and sniff out all those arbitrages, but not the deep down analysis of the S&D and then taking a position for 3 months or for 6 months, depending on when the market had moved from the level on the screen to what the S&D suggested was fair market price. And maybe that also explained a bit the intensity because, okay, yes, when you have a big position, fundamental position as a trader, it can be intense when the market goes against you and everyone walks around the desk and starts putting pressure on you. And you also know when you're right, you're too small. When you're wrong, you're too big. And even when you have nothing, when the market moves, you feel like shit, right? So that intensity, I understand. But if you need to market make for 12 hours a day, that's a different type of intensity, maybe also because you do not always feel fundamentally backed. So when you're wrong, in terms of the market goes against you, but you can rely on, guys, we have done the fundamental analysis, don't worry about this, we're going to sweat out the volatility, is maybe something different as a market maker when you're in your small little boat on a raging river, right? So my question is, what was really that the model which enabled you to make money? And maybe if that is correct, without the deep fundamental analysis of a longer term view of where the markets would go, how did you stay in the game?
Yeah. So when I joined Mandara, it was absolutely a market maker. I was trained by a guy on the desk who was, he probably still is the best market maker, I think, in all markets. He was phenomenal. And it was incredibly intense. And it was amazing. It was, I think it's a skill set that all traders should learn when they're starting out, because it's for risk management and for understanding a curve and for being able to price the market at any one point in time. It's absolutely fundamental, right? For me, it did not align with how I wanted to trade. And it took me maybe 2 or 3 years to realize this, because it's what I knew. I joined this place, it's what they do, this is what they're good at. And I trained at it and I was pretty good at it, but I hated it. I didn't like being glued to a machine for, as you say, 12, 14 hours a day and not having a view.
Yeah.
Like your view is, what's the price tick over the next second or 2 seconds or, you know, minute? That to me wasn't very interesting intellectually. And I guess in a way I was lucky, because then I was made head of trading. I got to define the strategy of the business a bit more and just define direction. But it was also defined a little bit for us, because at that time, 5 or 6 years ago, there's suddenly so many shops popping up with ex-Mandara employees or traders who were setting up as market making shops. So suddenly you've got best in the market coming in to compete at multiple different organizations. And at that point, we were going through a reset. When I took over the trading floor, it was very much there was very little in terms of experience on the floor at that time. So we had to rebuild. And I wanted to rebuild in a different way, because I didn't want that kind of race to the bottom, you know, that race to the bottom of ever tightening margins and having to just work harder and harder rather than smarter and smarter. So that's the point at which we started to transition a bit more. I don't think there's a huge jump from the market making to where we ended up, in the sense that when you're market making, you naturally get a really good understanding of the flows in the market, who's doing what at different times of the day. You start to understand how sticky prices at the back of the curve are, why they're sticky, who's constantly perennially on this cow bid next year, and why are they there, right? Are they a supplier, are they a consumer? And so you have all that information. So the next step is using it. Okay. So, and I think most traders, if they have enough time in the market, they should be able to find an edge. Like the problem is most people, they don't get a lot of time in the market, right? Because once you start trading, you got to start making money from the get-go. And if you haven't had good training, that's very difficult. So where we really transitioned is usually we remained very active and very good day traders. This is very different to market making. So we're not sit there all day making markets all the way down.
But with the market makes in between, yeah. Is that you use a platform for that or you use you just calling a broker? How did you?
Yeah. So the oil market's probably like the last bastion of OTC markets. So across all the different oil products there are, you know, there's a lot of curves, 100 plus curves, differentials between all of the individual products. Yeah. Most of them are still OTC traded and a lot of them are predominantly OTC traded. So you might have a screen on an exchange like ICE, or you might have a third party app that has some prices on. But outside of the futures contracts, a lot of it is OTC.
Brokers, then.
Brokers, exactly. So you're going down the line, you're talking to brokers. We have a box with maybe 20, 30, 40, 50 brokers on. They're shouting all day, every day, trying to find price matches between traders. And there's a lot of nuance in that. So again, like when you're learning to market make, you've got to be able to manage multiple lines. You've got to be able to take in a huge amount of information all the time, especially during like the window periods where you've got the price setting mechanism for that day, for the Asian markets in the morning, for the European and US markets in the afternoon and evening. Those periods of 30 minutes are incredibly intense. And you'll have 15, 20 brokers screaming at you. You've got your screens as well, where the numbers are also being quoted. So staying on top of all that information is really important. So it gives you a very good basis to learn to trade, but then using that information to take on more, either to develop strategies that work over time or to take on more kind of structured longer term positions was where we got to. So we always called it a lot of the strategies we run, we call like backtested strategies, right? With a human overlay. And the human overlay was, we've sat in these markets for 10, 12, 14 hours a day for years. We really know the players, what time of years they're going to hedge, what time of day, month, week they're going to hedge, the type of hedging programs, how those flows are going to move the market. And then we want to start taking on top the fundamentals, the seasonality of specific products, how these products interact with each other in the barrel, and start to create premises. Okay, we think at this time of year, we're going to see these same flows at this time of day. Can we generate a strategy out of that? Can we backtest that? Go and look in the data. Does that work over time? Yes, cool. Let's create signals that say, okay, green light, we're getting this because these fundamentals are right for this time of year. Let's start running a strategy. And then again, another overlay is the risk management. You can have a strategy that only makes money 30% of the time, but it can still be a very profitable strategy, right? If you get your risk management right, if you're making five or six times what you're losing every time you get a winning trade. So this was another key kind of tenet of what we were doing at Mandara, was really thinking very carefully about the entry and exit of trades. And the benefit that we had from being trained as market makers was that when you want to enter your trade, whether it's for 3 months or 6 months or for 30 minutes, you are going to have a much better view of when the best time to do that is, and also give yourself what we call a head start by being able to leg into it. If you're trading multiple curves that are differentials to each other, so they kind of look alike contracts, but across different products that have the ability to kind of switch between these products, that will give you the ability to leg into prices at different points of the curve at better levels than they're currently trading in the market. Okay. So all of these things combined to give us kind of definitely a very strong edge in trading shorter term trades. And what we were trying to build up was our edge, and which was much more difficult, right? You know, in terms of understanding the fundamentals. I mean, we had some robust conversations when you started. You're not a market maker, but you're not trading fundamentals. What are you doing? And this was, we knew when we were comfortable, we were never going to have a fundamental edge. We're a paper-only trader. We're getting our information from just the brokers and from Reuters or whatever you're subscribing to, right? So we don't own a part of that supply chain. We don't have ships moving around. So that's not going to be our edge. One of our edges, funnily, was that broker flow and understanding, because you start to understand that, like, when this guy is coming down and he's talking in this way, well, you know who's on the other end of the line, yeah. Shell, and you know they're going to hedge your cargo, and you know that this time, you know, they're always going to be selling. And so then you can start to avoid losing money, which is, you know, trading's as much about that as it is about making money, right? So this is kind of where we fell into over those kind of last 5 or 6 years of the business.
What is interesting about this is that indeed you guys have figured out that being in the flows and being on the phone and all those brokers is your edge, while in a more fundamentally driven market where you have the ability to build your S&Ds and have confidence in that, brokers are often seen as they're noise, right? Mm. And they just call to get business, and you don't want to talk to them because you don't want to be distracted from them, but therefore sometimes you miss a lot of stuff, a lot of trading opportunities before actually the fundamentals start to play, right? And in cargo, we used a metaphor referring to a book where we said, look, we know what the last page is. Yeah, we have confidence in our fundamental analysis and our whole, you know, access to the origin countries and customers. We know what the last page is. And because we know, we position ourselves and then I'm going to sit tight.
Yes.
But all those chapters in between, we didn't benefit from.
So
while you guys, you said, well, I don't know what is the last page is, but it is irrelevant because every page for us is an opportunity. Exactly, and we talk to all those brokers and we know who is behind. And indeed, very often by listening to the voice.
That was Martin.
He's in trouble. You just know it.
Yeah.
And even sometimes they call direct without the broker.
Yes.
And you know, and they are between a rock and a hard place and you can benefit from that. But when you sit there with your kind of long-term view, you miss because you think, well, okay, why should I now take a trade which goes against my fundamental view?
Yes.
I'm bucket long here. Why should I reduce my long bullish? Well, maybe because for 3 months, the market doesn't trade at all.
Yeah, or it has a lot of ups and downs in between your end page, right? And that's where you don't benefit from if you have a long-term vision, right? It's the same with buying equities. People say, just sit tight and just wait for it. Or you can be very agile and buy everything in between ups and downs and the movements. But then you have to be on top of that as well. And if you need to have the information to manage that. And if some markets don't allow you to have, for example, yours with the oil, maybe, and you know, you have so many brokers, then you get constant information. But I see in a lot of other markets, you don't have that. Maybe in cocoa, you don't have that, right? So, and there are much fewer players active as well. So then these ups and downs in between is also dangerous because if you can't move out of a position in between towards your end page, then you have a problem as well.
Yeah, I mean, trading is all about timing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think your analogy is very accurate, Martin. I guess what we wanted to do is we would always have a structural, the way I always trade my portfolio is I have a kind of a structural long or short in the book, you know, over the next 3 months or 6 months or whatever it is. So I am positioned for that. And that's my big chunk of my position. But I have my kind of short-term trading portfolio as well. And I trade that as if I've got no other position and no view on the market, because there's a lot of juice to pick up in the markets from just trading over a few hours or a few days or, you know.
But you do that to check your long-term position? Is that what you do? Is it for you like this barometer of where you feel like, am I still in the right long position or whatever?
A little bit, yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I just said, the part of my informational edge is gained from being actively involved in the markets and really having a decent view about what are all the different players doing. I mean, the oil markets are a lot bigger than, say, the cocoa market, but actually how many people really control the flows and maybe like 60-70% of each of these individual small oil products is very low as well. There might be 100 players in the market, but maybe 6 or 7 or 10 control 60% of the market. So those are the guys you really need to worry about.
And how did you deal with, because for oil, for me, it's like you have these massive oil countries, right? And they can basically push a button or open up the tap, basically. Mm. And that can have a massive impact on the markets, of course. And often oil countries are not like European countries or wherever, where you have a lot of democratic politics going over and they can just make quicker decisions.
Yes.
How do you deal with that?
So you try and be relative. I mean, a lot of what you're talking about is going to affect the flat price, the Brent crude or the WTI flat prices. And so generally we're going to try and structure our book that we are delta neutral. So for every $1 change in a price of Brent, you know, we know our product is going to move X amount and we try and make sure that we are as much as possible flattening that exposure so that if oil, I mean, of course, if oil moves $50, like a lot of these relationships are going to break down. But if oil swings up and down $5, $10, this is within the margin error where you know your delta is not going to swing around too much on these underlying more niche oil products. And if you think about the things that are going to move the needle on the price of, you know, US-based propane, which is predominantly used, you know, for kind of used for certain aspects in the US, but also internationally as well. Well, absolutely, it's going to move a lot with the price of oil up and down, but you can certainly hedge that out quite easily as well by just running small flat price positions against your overall data delta.
Because these benchmarks, so when I'm in with Vesper, I'm also in the world of these benchmarks. So yes. Like, and of course, the Brent oil price, one of the maybe the oldest, the biggest benchmarks out there in the world. How do you guys look at that, at this benchmark, like a WTI or a Brent?
We were never in the market for predicting the future price of Brent or TI. And I don't think anyone can do that. there are so far too many variables, right? And those are the known variables, like the unknown variables that come out every year, like it's impossible. So we never sat there and go, right, well, maybe sometimes we take a little punt, but we generally would never really want to be running a portfolio that has exposure to the kind of price machinations of these contracts, because it's a fool's game. Maybe Pierre Onderon thinks that he can predict that price of oil is going to go up by $50. But I mean, you are truly trying to guess God's work at that point. Yeah. Like, so we are really trying to neutralize risks outside of the specific price movements we're trying to capture. And that wouldn't just be for the overarching prices like Brent and WTI, would also be the kind of more, the smaller products within those markets as well. So you're really trying to say, okay, look, I think the price of this specific oil contract in this specific month is going to go up or down. That's the thing that I want to get into. You might have to run a portfolio of two or three different trades to get that exposure that you want.
Because would you say that the oil market is one of the most transparent markets in the world?
Yes, to a certain extent. I mean, it's a little bit like if you've got equities at one end of the spectrum, in terms of the number of people that are trading at any one time, you've got as close, you know, the price of one equity at any one time, I think, is as close to a perfect price as you could possibly have, because everyone has access to equal information. There's probably more opacity in the oil markets than that, because you've got such a huge number of players that control the flows of these markets. And so you can definitely have an edge in predicting price movements if you are the supplier of crude oil in X country, right? You're going to have a much better idea than I am about where the price move, because you know that you can control this little part of that kind of ultimate price. But it is, in terms of that's one end of the spectrum. I mean, Brent oil is, it's going to be fairly efficient in the sense that no one's really going to be able to predict it accurately. And that's kind of, I guess, a sign of efficiency. It's the price movement is basis, the all of the different integers that can happen at any one time, rather than one individual saying, I want the price to go up this way or that down that way.
Can you go a bit deeper, please, in that when you said it's a fool's game? Because there, I can imagine, or maybe I'm completely naive, but if I look at the big oil traders, well, one of them you're going to start, so Gunvor and Vitol, Trafigura, Mercuria, their job is to trade amongst, and they trade all kinds of oil derivatives, of course, but they trade crude oil as well, right? So basically, my question is, you mentioned, it's a fool's game. But I can imagine in those companies, like I described, they do spend hours in making the crude oil S&D and making an assessment of where it would go, right? And yeah, you need to make some guesses about what OPEC is going to do, and it's unpredictable, fine. But maybe as unpredictable as the weather, right?
Mm. So absolutely, they will. But they own a piece of that supply chain. Mm-hmm. The amount of barrels they have moving around the world at any one time will give them some small edge. Now, I don't think most of the time they're going to sit there and go, right, we want to be long X amount of derivative barrels of WTI or Brent or short it. At the end of the day, they're physical traders that are trying to move product from areas of low demand to areas of high demand. Yeah. And they want to lock in that profit when they do it. They don't want to be running flat price risk when they know that if they can move from Singapore, a tanker from Singapore to the US, that they're going to make a profit. Well, they want to lock that in. As a business overall, they're going to have a directional crude view.
Yeah.
And they're also going to want to hedge as much of that out as possible, unless they have a very, very strong view, like that COVID's kicked off and demand's going to go through the floor. Yes, I'm sure they're going to take a very sizable position of that.
But Onderant, you briefly touched base on him. That's his business model, is to trade crude directionally. Mm. No? Yeah? Or
yeah.
Not?
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't have access to his returns over time.
Yeah.
Do they beat like the S&P over the last 20, 30 years? You know, I mean, he was probably a very good trader. He's probably a very good salesperson and marketer. Is he very good at predicting the price of oil? I'd love to see those stats, because I would hazard guess he's probably not. Mm. Is he going to be much better than 50-50? Be interested to see.
Yeah. You mentioned risk management many, many times, huh?
Mm.
And that's also, you know, something that the media is quite often surprised about. Because the media, they see maybe Onderon, but also some of the major oil traders that I mentioned, they see these huge returns and they think, okay, these are speculators. That's what the mainstream media believes. While indeed, a lot of the time you spend time on risk management now. And like I said in the introduction, you prepared the risk policy of Mandara now. And I've been making these things myself. In Cargill, and I was really, really impressed by it. Could you share with us what was the core of it
mm.
and how you made it? And because You told me that a large part of the document was written by you.
Yes.
When I read it, I thought, hey, this is a guy with a huge experience, and it is in some areas is better than I've seen.
So you're still so young, eh?
No, but it was really like one of the best documents in terms of risk management that I've ever read. Mm. Could you share with us how you went about writing that, and what is your philosophy behind it?
Yeah, well, thank you for that. So, well, the overarching philosophy of our risk management, which was defined by the board, was never blow up. Okay, so this is the primary thing you're trying to do as a business. I kind of built this risk policy and documents over time. The first one was really growing on what I'd been taught when I joined Mandara, which was a set of principles and philosophies about how to operate in the oil markets. Some of this was technical, right? So going back to our overarching aim of never blowing up. So knowing how to hedge out the delta risk, knowing how to do your daily TAS hedging, you know, all of these different things that kept the business going day to day. You know, one thing we used at Mandara, which was, I think, was brilliant addition by the owner, was checklists. In the same way that surgeons or fighter pilots use checklists, we just, for every desk and for the business as a whole, we had a criteria of different things that if we didn't do on a daily basis, could risk the going concern of the business. But they're also small, kind of annoying things that you had to do every day that you were likely to forget about. So this is why we had these. So I built on the kind of more technical side of how to risk manage the business, but I also built into it how we should operate in the markets, how you should trade, never doing anything that is either going to break regulatory rules or exchange rules, no spoofing, how you should operate with the brokers. We wanted to be a business that was trusted and respected in the markets. So the language we used, never flaking, operating in this space where we knew, especially over the last few years of the business, a lot of our competitors were not abiding by similar principles. And it meant that we were always, you know, very top of the list of a port of call when people had good flow to come to us. Layering on top of this, then one of the issues we had at Mandara was that I was the risk manager of the business. I was also a trader. I was also head of trading, managing the traders. This was a lot of hats to wear, and it was also not great policy, you know, having a trader doing all these other things as well. The owner was okay with it because he trusted me, but we also recognized it wasn't great. It's going to distract me and mean I'm doing lots of jobs not particularly well. It was also create a big key person risk because if I get hit by a bus, you know, we've got no one to step into that seat and do those roles. So I really wanted to create a risk management framework that would allow the traders to know exactly where their red lines were, how they could operate within the parameters of their book, you know, VARs, the P&L drawdowns we're comfortable with, all this sort of thing, position sizes. And allow me to be completely hands-off, but I could call up whenever I needed to see where we sat within those kind of risk parameters. So I wanted something automated that would, as the business was making money or individual traders were making money, they were allowed to take more risk, especially when the market conditions were conducive to that. So when there was extreme volatility, but also extreme liquidity as well. And equally, or as in, probably more importantly, as the market conditions degrade, so you've got high volatility, low liquidity, and the traders are not making money, or losing money, obviously, then their risk would be ramped down and ratcheted down. So we built these kind of two parts of the risk management business, which was how to operate in the markets, how culturally, how we wanted the traders to operate. And this was I said this before, this was one of our, I think, key strengths as a business. Like the traders were all excellent risk managers from a very kind of early point in their career. And maybe that gave away some of the upsides, but it meant that we were always in the game. And it was really culturally ingrained into them. And we never had problems really with anything to do with risk, except when we brought in experienced traders who brought in their own baggage, their own way of risk managing. And almost always it meant that they were taking much more risk than they thought they were or than we were comfortable with. And then the flip side of that is, as I said, this kind of automated profile for giving the traders free rein to scale up when they're doing well, scale up when the conditions are right. But equally, they know they've got to start cutting risk when things are not going well. And that was, again, something that worked really well because I didn't have to tap anyone on the shoulder ever and say, you know, we need to start taking money off the table here. They knew when to do it and they did it. And that's important because traders, you know, it's a confidence game as much as anything. No one likes losing money, but it's even worse when someone's standing over your shoulder, tapping you and saying, right, you need to start taking risk off. If they have ultimate control of their freedom there, then it's good for everyone.
You trade the biggest when you trade the best, huh? And the smallest when you trade shit. But it is good that you have predefined rules for it,
yeah.
So you do not have any emotional discussions about it when it happens, right?
Yeah, and as you know, for me, this is one of the things that I believe truly as a trader is, and it's a lot, I think many traders struggle with this. If the market's not working for me, if I'm not making money or I just don't get it, I will take everything off the table. Mm. I will just start again from a blank sheet of paper. It doesn't matter if it's day one of the year or day 300 of the year. And a lot of traders, I think, struggle with that. They're losing money and they want to fight it. They want to try and get it back. As soon as you clear your book, it's like you're crystallizing the losses.
It's incredibly interesting that, and that confirmation bias. I've had it so many times that you sit in a position and you're more receptive for the news that is confirming your position. Mm. It goes against you. At the end of the day, you eventually get out. And all of a sudden, your mind is relieved. It's completely clear. And then all of a sudden, you see much more elements, also the stuff that is contradicting that that position. The trap is then to immediately go to the other side.
Yeah.
Because it feels psychologically like a huge defeat.
Yes.
If you go out and then later on go in the exact same direction that you went out, right?
But so doing nothing you feel is like, hard, eh?
Yeah, no.
That's one of the most important things in trading, right? Yeah. And this is why, I guess this is going back to your point about where we sat. We were certainly not market makers because we were very comfortable sitting on our hands and with no positions on. And we did this quite regularly. If we didn't have an edge, we didn't want to trade.
Yeah. Now, also one thing that why I wanted to have Ed in the podcast, because there was something that he does differently than other traders. You see him speaking online. So he also writes about his experience on LinkedIn. There are not many traders who do it, and certainly not credible people who do it. So you do see a lot of people talking about that they're in the market. Let's not talk about all the assets they're in, but you can see that they have no credibility in terms of their profiles. And Ed obviously has. So I like the fact that he was sharing his experience on LinkedIn, for example. And there's two things that I wrote down, which you find in his LinkedIn profile and which resonates with me. And he said, now, trading was broken down to a finite set of skills and rebuilt as a fine art. Now, I also thought that trading is, he calls it an art, I call it a craft. And online, there is often the suggestion, it's like a casino, right? And everyone can do it. And therefore you have those tempting day trading courses and day trading, shillers. Well, I think, no, it's an art, it's a craft, and you need to make all those hours and you can't learn that from a course.
Yes.
So there's one thing, and linked to that, we talked about it as well in the podcast already. He said, I've always focused on the heavy element of individual and group psychology in the small niche oil market that I trade in. And this is about the craft and psychology. Now, can you share or elaborate a bit more to the audience about why those two things are so important and why they, hopefully you agree with me, so neglect some of those course sellers and awful people that you find on X or LinkedIn who kind of tarnish what I think is the real profession, being a professional trader.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely do agree with you. I mean, this is why we end up talking in the first place, because I was reading your posts on LinkedIn and they align very closely with how we operate at Mandara and thought at Mandara. We talked about trade craft a lot. In our training, what we tried to do was teach people three kind of facets of trading. Okay, so first of all, the fundamentals. You've got to understand what you're trading. What's that product? What's the kind of intricacies of those markets? Where do the flows come from? Where's the production? Where's the consumption? What are the uses? You know, all of these things. You have to understand that. And the second piece was the risk management. Okay. So how do you formulate trades where you are going to make more than you lose, that you stay in the game, you know, all the things we've talked about. And the third piece was around tradecraft, that edge creation. Okay, so how do you actually go out there and find these things? And that was the art part. So the two first bits were much more around the craft of trading, the understanding the markets, understanding how you operate. But then that kind of art part piece of it, we still tried to give traders a leg up there in that kind of edge creation piece, where we tried to give them a way of looking at the markets. We talked about heuristics a lot.
What is that?
Heuristics. So heuristics are kind of like mind maps or like, you know, shortcuts where you can start to see repeatable patterns and operate repeatable and execute repeatable patterns very quickly. Like we look for shortcuts and heuristics in our day-to-day life all the time. And so this is one of the things that the founder, you know, really pushed a lot, and he was very right for, because in all of these markets, you see the same kind of patterns happening all the time because the flows are always the same. the oil is coming from here and it's going to there, and these are the consumers and these are the buyers. So when do they operate in the market? When do they do their hedging? You know, again, like a lot of the day's hedging is done during those kind of short physical windows at the start and the end of the day where there's a huge amount of volume going through. Well, you start to see the same patterns. So this helps you to get involved in the markets and start to realize you do know a bit. And you would be amazed at how many people who trade these markets don't any idea about these sorts of things, where you should really know that these guys are hedging in the morning, these guys are buying in the afternoon and all this sort of thing. So that's kind of the art piece to it of saying, okay, we're starting to understand and see patterns in the markets. What aligns with your individual skill sets as a trader, as a person? What are you good at, and where are you going to kind of follow that to and start trying to create strategies and build a business out of it, essentially? And that is where that really has to come from the individual. That can't be taught. The second piece around, my edge in the markets, we've talked about a little bit, but in these markets, a big part of each product is going to be owned by a small number of players. Well, if you know those people, you've had lunch with them, you've been out with them, you also understand their business, you understand how they operate, and you start to understand who they will talk to in terms of brokers and, how they will hedge their flows, you can start to get a much better understanding of the markets, of the way that they will move throughout the year, and equally how they'll react to certain situations. How will they react when they're losing money? Because when they're losing money, whether they're structurally long as a business or structurally short as a business. So what are they going to do in those times? Are they going to go quiet and you're not going to see them? And so, a load of liquidity is going to go out of that product, or are they going to go and start trying to grind it out and start throwing, money around in different markets and this sort of thing? So for me, it goes back to what I said at the start of this podcast around when I was playing poker. I love sitting opposite someone at the table, looking at them and trying to understand what their thought process was. And this is a very similar way of looking at the markets. It's made up of a very small, finite number of players in at any one time who have a vested interest in the price going one way or the other. How are they going to react to different price movements and different, as you talked about, Alexander, news flows that Saudis are suddenly turning on the taps or turning off the taps and this sort of thing. Once you can start to formulate opinion of how different players in the market will operate under different circumstances, then that, again, it gives you another layer to trade with.
It's like Harvey Specter says in Suits, he says, when he plays poker, he always plays the man, not the cards. Mm.
I say that. I probably wasn't good enough to do it, but I say it at least.
So a lot of people in the audience, and they want to understand, and probably because that is their retail experience, they want to understand, how do you deal with the intensity? And we talked about it quite often, and one of the best books that I read about it was What I've Learned Losing $1 Million. And this is about the psychology of dealing with, the pressure to make money, but also the intensity of dealing with the market that goes against you. Maybe also along the way about your career progression. Maybe you see other people on the floor who do better than you, and you think about, how is my career going to progress, and things like promotions. People walking along the desk, senior walking along the desk, they know exactly who is making money and who isn't. Everyone knows that you are the desk that isn't making money or missed a huge opportunity, these kind of things. How did you over time manage to condition yourself that it didn't impact how you felt, or maybe how you treated your girlfriend or your friends? How did you keep sane?
Maybe you should ask my wife this and she'd tell you if I'd done,
You always get a different answer when you talk about that one.
I kind of look at my life relatively holistically, and it's a bit more difficult since I had kids, because a lot of the old rules and the ways you want to live your life go out the window pretty quickly. But I always treated my body and my mind as important to my trading as being at the desk and hitting the button and all this sort of thing. So, I've always stayed fit. So I meditate, I watch what I eat. I mean, I have my vices, of course. You have to, because you've got to go and have fun at the end of it. But I try and keep myself in a good routine focused way of living, so that not having to make lots of decisions and not having to deal with lots of noise when I'm already in a job, as you alluded to, which is stressful and involves long hours. And it's definitely been harder and easier since having kids. I've traded a lot better because I've cared less, because suddenly you've got this thing, you find your place in the world, right, where all of the other stuff doesn't matter, really. That's what's important. And so when I first sat down, especially with our second, who we had some health problems, and I sat down at the desk, I was like, it freed me to make the best decision at any time, because I didn't care about the consequence. So at that time, I could really trade in a completely unencumbered, zero ego way that I'd never really achieved before. It's a shame we had to go through what we did to get to that point. But this is like a really interesting realization for me. It was very different to when I had my first, actually, because I had this other thing happen in my head where when I had Max, where it was almost like a switch. I was like, I've got this dependent now. It never mattered before. You know, it was always just fun. And so actually I traded very badly at that point because I'm like trying to grind out every penny in the market and be really active. And it was very against me. And it took me 6 months to be like, what am I doing? This is not how I trade or operate. So the things I do to kind of keep myself in a good space is one thing. But ultimately, I think it's when you're learning any new skill and trading, you'll be learning for as long as you're doing it. In a way, you have to kind of force yourself into periods where you're really uncomfortable. And a lot of time the market will do that for you. That's why it's one benefit, you know, you go from never having lost X amount and then you lose 10X in one trade. And you're like, oh, well, the world still spins around. No one's been hurt. No one's died. Like you kind of have to go through those. And some people struggle with those adjustments. And one of the ways that we tried at Mandara to make sure that we would bring people on that were able to deal with those kind of those mental leaps and the stress and strains of the roles was look for people who have experience and manage risk in real life. We hired a lot of poker players. Two of the best traders we ever had was a poker player and a sports bettor, because they were, when they joined us, they already understood implicitly odds and putting your money in the middle when, you know, you had the best hand. So that was easy. But they also were comfortable. They'd been sitting running their own money, you know, for 5, 6, 7 years. So trading someone else's money was easy for them. They were the quickest up the curve by a mile, because it was just like, great, now I don't need to worry about that stuff where I'm managing my own money. I can just actually know that I'm making the right decision, best decision every time. That was really cool. The flip side of that is when someone's never really been tested, like, you know, you have a lot of people that say they want to trade and they've never really gained any, you know, financial exposure. Well, then it's very hard to know how you're going to react under those circumstances. So we always wanted people to show, and they didn't need to be risking money, because actually paper trading, if that's, you know, when you're starting out, is as good a skill as any you can have. And if it means it's the difference between you becoming a good trader and getting a job or not, that's enough risk, you know, to make people, you know, to demonstrate whether you're any good at it or not. But we always wanted people to have a kind of an understanding of what it meant to take risk in life and to sit with losses and that sort of thing.
I've seen you train the youngsters on the desk. And that's also something that I thought was different with Ed than with a lot of other senior traders. He really enjoyed educating young people and training them. What is your philosophy? So what is the things that you focus on with young people?
So when I joined Mandara, although I had traded for a couple of years, I really didn't know my head from my ass, right? So I was trained and I was given this opportunity to forge this career, which, you know, no one had to do that. You know, this is why I joined the business and why I was so impressed by M, the owner, because he wanted to give people the skills to unlock this career. And he, from day one, he wanted to give people the opportunity who wouldn't necessarily be able to operate in the city. You know, he liked outsiders. He liked people that didn't fit the normal mold of what traders would want to be. He wanted to give them the keys to the kingdom, essentially. I love that. And I fully agree with that kind of way of operating. And, you know, when I've been given this opportunity and been trained in the way I had, it was the least I could do to give other people a leg up when they were getting going. I think with training, it's a little bit like managing. You've got to be good at it and you've got to want to do it. One of the difficulties in any office environment is, you know, when you're good as a trader, well, then you're kind of forced into this position of having to become probably a trainer and then probably a manager. And you're moving that individual away from their skill set, the thing they're really good at, and putting them in a place where they're going to be maybe uncomfortable, maybe not enjoying their role as much. So we tried to be selective in who we had training. And as I said, I enjoyed it and I was good at it. So that was fine. It was a good fit. How I trained people was the same as how I traded, which was master the basics, you know, over and over again. You want to repeat like your knowledge, your understanding, your how you operate, you know, on a very basic level. So it's ingrained in you and never forget that. You know, it doesn't matter if you've been training for a year or 50 years, like you've got to have those rules, those principles, how you operate. You know, I love Dennis Gartland's rules, which just stood the test of time. And, you know, my first boss on my training desk, Rocky, the funny story behind that name, he introduced me to these rules. And it was like, yeah, I love that. I love that you've got this thing where you've got to you get a framework to operate and live your career. So I did the same thing. I built my own rules up over time. And I think anyone should do that. But when I train people, from day one, it's like, okay, learn the basics and then start to layer on other things, the fundamentals or how you look for strategies or these things, but always, always revert back to those basics so that when the shit hits the fan and everything's going wrong, like we just talked about, you can reset, you can go to a blank sheet of paper and you can build the business back up. And that's the thing that was the hardest to find in people. People who are, you know, my favorite quote, Mike Tyson, everyone's got a plan until they get hit in the face. And that was that was my USP as a trader. I get hit in the face all the time and I can still stick to a plan and have a plan. But a lot of people, that's not how they operate, right? Yeah. When the shit hits the fan, it's like the wheels fall off and, you know, so.
Yep.
I think he said, like, till you get punched in the mouth.
Yeah, sure.
Same thing.
One thing, what I also found interesting, because you refer to M. Quite often, and as the founder of Mandara, and similar to what we discussed with Tom Kupczynski when Wim Koiker was the founder of Blenheim, there is always something like almost mythical. And so I had heard a lot about M, and I thought, well, is this some kind of a James Bond type of guy? And I was fortunate enough to meet him and to have we had breakfast or lunch. Yeah, I think it was breakfast, yeah. Very impressive guy in terms of how knowledgeable he was, but also how he didn't have an ego. He was very accessible, extremely kind. I thought, wow, and this is indeed a very charismatic guy and has been training the oils market himself. Oh, and then became an entrepreneur, put his own money at risk. Super interesting. What are the things that you learned from him?
The primary thing that I've taken away from, you know, our time together and our relationship is living a kind of principled existence. And I think I operate that way to a certain extent in my private life, but also in the trading world, it's quite rare to kind of think about that sort of thing. And for me, it's very important. And, you know, like, for example, what we were just talking about is giving back and, you know, helping other people out when you've been given those opportunities and things like this are very important. But that kind of works in the markets as well. You know, how you treat other people in the market, how you operate, you know, how you function, can be an edge. You know, when you mentioned, you know, you can hear down the other end of the line, this guy you've been trading with for 20 years, their back's against the wall. I mean, a lot of people go, right, great, let's rip their eyes out. But you might see more business sense and you might feel better giving them a way out that is obviously good for you, but also not so bad for them. So thinking about things like this a bit, I was very grateful for the opportunities he afforded me during my time at Mandara. I was given a lot of responsibility at a time when I probably didn't have the experience to warrant it, probably didn't have the skills to warrant it. And, you know, we've both been, I got engaged, got married, had my kids all while at Mandara. You know, I grew up in this business. And when I had some difficult times with my family, he was there. The business was there for me in a way that I never could have expected. And vice versa, you know, he had some difficult times over the years as well. And I like to think I did as well as I could during those periods to support him and, you know, his what was going on in his life. So, you know, he's definitely been a mentor to me over those years, but I'm really grateful he's a friend now as well, because I've learned a huge amount from him and he's also a lot of fun. You go out and have a few drinks with him.
Yeah. And I think also interesting for our audience to know, and, you know, knowing now also who you are and that you share some of your experiences. You're going to move to Gunvor in October. Could you share with us what you're going to do and what you're looking forward to?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm joining the LPG desk there, well, the light ends portfolio as a whole. So obviously I predominantly traded paper before. I'm going there to sit with the LPG team in London, but to trade my own portfolio, still focusing on LPG. And it's going to be a great opportunity for me to learn. The guys there are really sort of best in class for the LPG market. And they have a very good physical business. And that's kind of, it's going to be nice to look behind the curtain, so to speak, a little bit. You know, what I've learned of the physical market is really from conversations over a beer and this sort of thing, and to see how they operate their business, to see how they trade around their assets is going to be really, really amazing for me to kind of be able to develop on my trading kind of styles and the way I operate in the market as well. And hopefully I'll be able to show them a little bit of how to operate in a paper market better. So,
so you're going to bring something to the table.
Yes. I think they think so. So I've got to, try and do something.
Very cool. Thanks. Then this is the real end. I think it was a fantastic podcast. I really enjoyed. And I think the story, indeed, what you said in the beginning, you know, you feel still young. You are still young, and things that you've experienced, knowledge that you have about these markets, but also I think about yourself and how you trade, how you operate, the principles of you as a person, how you trade is all very interesting. And what you say, I can refer to myself as well. It feels, yeah, really natural, but very knowledgeable as well. So yeah, really cool. Really, really enjoyed it. And I wish you all the best at Gunfor.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be here. And it's been a really, really interesting conversation. I get on very well with Martin. You know, we've not spent too much time together. So yeah, thank you very much for having me and having a chat with me.
I think the podcast for me is what I hoped it was. And you see that there's a lot of depth in what you need to do as a trader. And you see that Ed is able to really well articulate it.
Yeah, your English is really good for an Englishman.
The English is good.
No, and you both speak better English than me.
No, no, sure.
And it's a nice combination about content, so capabilities that you have, things you've learned, and also psychology and dealing with that and thinking about it. Yeah, so a great example for people willing to work in the in the industry.
And if you see him across the table with poker, then be careful. You know, he's counting your cards.
My friends wouldn't think so. That
they're laughing.
What's the expression? If you can't see the fish at the table, then you are the fish.
Oh, right. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, guys.